official procedure for acknowledging our complaints. They did so, but only in the most perfunctory manner. Every Saturday morning, the chief warder would come into our section and call out, "Complaints and requests! Complaints and requests!" Those of us with complaints and requests, which was nearly everyone, lined up to see the chief warder. One by one, we would make formal complaints about food or clothing or visits. To each, the chief warder would nod his head and simply say, "Yeah, yeah," and then, "Next." He did not even write down what we said. If we tried to speak for our organizations, the warder would yell, "No ANC or PAC here. Understand?" Shortly before the Red Cross's visit, we had submitted a formal list of complaints to the Commissioner of Prisons. At the time, we were only permitted paper and pencil to write letters. We had secretly consulted with each other at the quarry and in the lavatory and put together a list. We submitted it to our chief warder, who did not want to take it and accused us of violating regulations by making such a list. One of our complaints to the Red Cross would be that the authorities did not listen to our complaints. On the day of their visit, I was called to the head office to meet with the Red Cross representative. That year, and for the following few years, the representative was a Mr. Sen, a former director of prisons in his native Sweden who had emigrated to Rhodesia. Sen was a quiet, rather nervous man in his mid-50s who did not seem at all comfortable in his surroundings. The meeting was not monitored, a critical difference from nearly all of our other visitors. He asked to hear all of our complaints and grievances and listened very carefully, taking extensive notes. He was very courteous and thanked me for all that I told him. Even so, that first visit was rather tense. Neither of us yet knew what to expect from the other. I complained quite vociferously about our clothing, affirming that we did not want to wear short trousers and needed proper clothing, including socks and underwear, which we were not then given. I recounted our grievances regarding food, visits, letters, studies, exercise, hard labor, and the behavior of warders. I made certain requests I knew the authorities would never satisfy, such as our desire to be transferred to prisons nearer our homes. After our session, Sen met with the Commissioner of Prisons and his staff while I waited. I assumed that he relayed our complaints to the authorities, indicating the ones he thought were reasonable. Not long after Sen's visit, our clothing did improve and we were given long trousers. But Sen was not a progressive fellow by any means. His years in Rhodesia seemed to have acclimatized him to racism. Before I had returned to my cell, I reminded him of our complaint that African prisoners did not receive bread. Mr. Sen appeared flustered and glanced over at the colonel, who was head of the prison. "Bread is very bad for your teeth, you know, Mandela," Mr. Sen said. "Mealies are much better for you. They make your teeth strong." In later years, the International Red Cross sent more liberal men who wholeheartedly fought for improvements. The organization also played a critical role in an area that was less obvious but no less important to us. They often provided money to wives and relatives who would not otherwise have been able to visit us on the island. After we had been sent to Robben Island, there was concern among our supporters that we would not be permitted to study. Within a few months of our arrival, the authorities announced that those who wanted to study could apply for permission. Most of the men did so, and even though they were D-group prisoners, permission was granted. The state, after the Rivonia trial, was feeling confident and thought giving us study privileges would be harmless. Later, they came to regret it. Postgraduate study was not permitted, but they made an exception in my case because I had established a precedent when I was in Pretoria. Very few of the men in our section had BAs, and many registered for university-level courses. Quite a few did not have high school degrees and elected courses to qualify for that degree. Some of the men were already well-educated, like Govan Mbeki and Neville Alexander, but others had not gone past Standard 5 or 6. Within months, virtually all of us were studying for one degree or another. At night, our cell block seemed more like a study hall than a prison. But the privilege of studying came with a host of conditions. Certain subjects, such as politics and military history, were prohibited. For years, we were not permitted to receive funds except from our families, so that poor prisoners rarely had money for books or tuition. This made the opportunity to study a function of how much money one had. Nor were we permitted to lend books to other prisoners, which would have enabled our poorer colleagues to study. There was always controversy about whether or not we should accept study privileges. Some members of the Unity Movement at first felt that we were accepting a handout from the government, which compromised our integrity. They argued that studying should not be a conditional privilege, but an unfettered right. While I agreed, I could not accept that we should therefore disavow studying. As freedom fighters and political prisoners, we had an obligation to improve and strengthen ourselves, and study was one of the few opportunities to do so. Prisoners were permitted to enroll at either the University of South Africa, UNISA, or Rapid Results College, which was for those studying for their high school qualification. In my own case, studying under the auspices of the University of London was a mixed blessing. On the one hand, I was assigned the sorts of stimulating books that would not have been on a South African reading list. On the other, the authorities inevitably regarded many of them as unsuitable and thus banned them. Receiving books at all was often a challenge. You might make an application to a South African library for a book on contract law. They would process your request and then send you the book by post. But because of the vagaries of the mail system, the remoteness of the island, and the often deliberate slowness of the censors, the book would reach you after the date that it needed to be returned. If the date had passed, the warders would typically send the book back without even showing it to you. Given the nature of the system, you might receive a late fine without ever having received the book. In addition to books, we were permitted to order publications necessary to our studies. The authorities were extremely strict about this, and the only kind of publication that would pass muster might be a quarterly on actuarial science for a prisoner studying accounting. But one day, Mac Maharaj told a comrade who was studying economics to request The Economist. We laughed and said we might as well ask for Time magazine, because The Economist was also a news weekly. But Mac simply smiled and said the authorities wouldn't know that. They judged a book by its title. Within a month, we were receiving The Economist and reading the news we hungered for. But the authorities soon discovered their mistake and ended the subscription. Once most of the men began to study, we complained that we did not even have the minimum facilities necessary for studying, such as desks and chairs. I made this complaint to the International Red Cross. Finally, the authorities built in each cell a kind of stand-up desk, a simple wooden board that jutted out from the wall at about chest level. This was not precisely what we had envisaged. After a tedious day at the quarry, one did not much feel like working at a stand-up desk. A number of us complained about the desks, and Kathy was the most vociferous. He informed the commanding officer that not only was it an imposition to have stand-up desks, but that they sloped so steeply that the books fell off. The commanding officer made a surprise visit to Kathy's cell, asked for a book, and plunked it on his desk. It did not move. He asked Kathy for another, and placed it on top of the first one. Again, nothing happened. Finally, after placing four books on the desk, he turned to a sheepish Kathy and said, "Ach, there's nothing wrong with these desks," and walked out. But about 6 months later, the authorities relented and we were given three-legged wooden stools and the stand-up desks were lowered. One complaint I voiced to the International Red Cross concerned the arbitrary way we were charged by the warders. To be charged meant that a warder claimed that a prisoner had violated a specific regulation which could be punished by isolation or by loss of meals and privileges. Warders generally did not treat this lightly, For when a prisoner was charged, he was allowed a judicial hearing, and, depending on the seriousness of the offense, a magistrate was brought in from Cape Town. At the time, the authorities were refusing to permit hearings. When I complained to the International Red Cross about this, I had yet to experience the problem myself, but that situation was soon remedied. On weekends, during our first year on the island, we were kept inside our cells all day except for a half hour of exercise. One Saturday, after returning from exercise in the courtyard, I noticed that a warder had left a newspaper on the bench at the end of the corridor. He had become rather friendly to us, and I assumed that he had not left the newspaper there by accident. Newspapers were more valuable to political prisoners than gold or diamonds, more hungered for than food or tobacco. They were the most precious contraband on Robben Island. News was the intellectual raw material of the struggle. We were not allowed any news at all, and we craved it. Walter, even more than myself, seemed bereft without news. The authorities attempted to impose a complete blackout. They did not want us to learn anything that might raise our morale or reassure us that people on the outside were still thinking about us. We regarded it as our duty to keep ourselves current on the politics of the country, and we fought long and hard for the right to have newspapers. Over the years, we devised many ways of obtaining them, but back then we were not so adept. One of the advantages of going to the quarry was that warders' sandwiches were wrapped in newspaper, and they would often discard these newspaper wrappers in the trash where we secretly retrieved them. We would distract the warders' attention, pluck the papers out of the garbage, and slide them into our shirts. One of the most reliable ways to acquire papers was through bribery, and this was the only area where I tolerated what were often unethical means of obtaining information. The warders always seemed to be short of money, and their poverty was our opportunity. When we did get hold of a paper, it was far too risky to pass around. Possession of a newspaper was a serious charge. Instead, one person would read the paper, usually Kathy or, later, Mac Maharaj. Kathy was in charge of communications, and he had thought of ingenious ways for us to pass information. Kathy would go through the paper and make cuttings of relevant stories, which were then secretly distributed to the rest of us. Each of us would write out a summary of the story we were given. These summaries were then passed among us and later smuggled to the general section. When the authorities were particularly vigilant, Kathy or Mac would write out his summary of the news and then destroy the paper, usually by tearing it into small pieces and placing it in his body, which the warders never inspected. When I noticed the newspaper lying on the bench, I quickly left my cell, walked to the end of the corridor, looked in both directions, and then plucked the newspaper off the bench and slipped it into my shirt. Normally, I would have hidden the newspaper somewhere in my cell and taken it out only after bedtime. But like a child who eats his sweet before his main course, I was so eager for news that I opened the paper in my cell immediately. I don't know how long I was reading. I was so engrossed in the paper that I did not hear any footsteps. Suddenly, an officer and two other warders appeared, and I did not even have time to slide the paper under my bed. I was caught black and white-handed, so to speak. "Mandela," the officer said, "we are charging you for possession of contraband, and you will pay for this." The two warders then began a thorough search of my cell to see if they could turn up anything else. Within a day or two, a magistrate was brought in from Cape Town, and I was taken to the room at headquarters that was used at the island's court. In this instance, the authorities were willing to call in an outside magistrate because they knew they had an open and shut case. I offered no defense and was sentenced to 3 days in isolation and deprivation of meals. I do not think that I was set up by the warder who left the newspaper on the bench, though some assumed I had been. At the hearing, the authorities grilled me as to how I got the newspaper, and I refused to answer. If I had been railroaded, the authorities would have known how I'd gotten it. The isolation cells were in our same complex, but in another wing. Although just across the courtyard, they felt enormously distant. In isolation, one was deprived of company, exercise, and even food. One received only rice water 3 times a day for 3 days. Rice water is simply water in which rice has been boiled. By comparison, our normal ration of pep seemed like a feast. The first day in isolation was always the most painful. One grows accustomed to eating regularly, and the body is not used to being deprived. I found that by the second day I had more or less adjusted to the absence of food, and the third passed without much craving at all. Such deprivation was not uncommon among Africans in everyday life. I myself had gone without food for days at a time in my early years in Johannesburg. As I have already mentioned, I found solitary confinement the most forbidding aspect of prison life. There is no end and no beginning. There is only one's own mind which can begin to play tricks. Was that a dream, or did it really happen? One begins to question everything. Did I make the right decision? Was my sacrifice worth it? In solitary, there is no distraction from these haunting questions. But the human body has an enormous capacity for adjusting to trying circumstances. I have found that one can bear the unbearable if one can keep one's spirit strong even when one's body is being tested. Strong convictions are the secret of surviving deprivation. Your spirit can be full even when your stomach is empty. In those early years, isolation became a habit. We were routinely charged for the smallest infractions and sentenced to isolation. A man might lose his meals for a sidelong glance, or be sentenced for failing to stand when a warder entered the room. Some PAC prisoners, who often flouted the rules simply for the sake of doing so, spent a great deal of time in isolation. The authorities believed that isolation was the cure for our defiance and rebelliousness. The second time I was charged and spent time in isolation occurred shortly after the first. As I have mentioned, we were having great difficulty making our complaints heard. The remoteness of the prison made the authorities feel they could ignore us with impunity. They believed that if they turned a deaf ear to us, we would give up in frustration, and the people on the outside would forget about us. One day we were working at the lime quarry when the commanding officer came to observe us, accompanied by a gentleman whom we at first did not recognize. One of my colleagues whispered to me that it was Brigadier Okomp from the head office, our commanding officer's commanding officer. He is not to be confused with the Okomp of Pretoria Local, who looked after us during the Rivonia trial. The two men stood at a distance, watching us. Okomp was a short, heavy-set fellow in a suit rather than a military uniform. He normally came to the island on biannual inspections. On those occasions, we were ordered to stand at attention at the grill of our cells and hold up our prison cards as he walked by. I decided that Okomp's unexpected appearance was a singular opportunity to present our grievances to the man who had the power to remedy them. I put down my pick and began to walk over to them. The warders immediately became alarmed and moved toward me. I knew that I was violating regulations, but I hoped the warders would be so surprised by the novelty of my action that they would do nothing to stop me. That proved to be the case. When I reached the two men, the commanding officer said bluntly, "Mandela, go back to your place. No one called you." I disregarded him and addressed Okomp, saying I had taken this extraordinary action because our complaints were being ignored. The CO interrupted me. "Mandela, I order you back to your place." I turned to him and said in a measured tone, "I am here already. I will not go back." I was hoping that Okomp would agree to hear me out. But he studied me coldly, and then turned to the warders and said calmly, "Charge him." I continued to speak as the guards led me away. "Take him back to the cells," the CO said. I was charged, and, once again, I had no defense. The punishment this time was 4 days in isolation. There was a lesson in what I had done, a lesson I already knew, but had disobeyed out of desperation. No one, least of all prison officials, ever likes to have his authority publicly challenged. In order to respond to me, Ocomp would have had to humiliate his subordinate. Prison officials responded much better to private overtures. The best way to effect change on Robben Island was to attempt to influence officials privately rather than publicly. I was sometimes condemned for appearing to be too accommodating to prison officials, but I was willing to accept the criticism in exchange for the improvement. Chapter 66. The most important person in any prisoner's life is not the Minister of Justice, not the Commissioner of Prisons, not even the head of prison, but the warder in one's section. If you are cold and want an extra blanket, you might petition the Minister of Justice, but you will get no response. If you go to the Commissioner of Prisons, he will say, "Sorry, it is against regulations." The head of prison will say, "If I give you an extra blanket, I must give one to everyone." But if you approach the warder in your corridor and you are on good terms with him, he will simply go to the stockroom and fetch a blanket. I always tried to be decent to the warders in my section. Hostility was self-defeating. There was no point in having a permanent enemy among the warders. It was ANC policy to try to educate all people, even our enemies. We believed that all men, even prison service warders, were capable of change, and we did our utmost to try to sway them. In general, we treated the warders as they treated us. If a man was considerate, we were considerate in return. Not all of our warders were ogres. We noticed right from the start that there were some among them who believed in fairness. Yet, being friendly with warders was not an easy proposition, for they generally found the idea of being courteous to a black man abhorrent. Because it was useful to have warders who were well disposed toward us, I often asked certain men to make overtures to selected warders. No one liked to take on such a job. We had one warder at the quarry who seemed particularly hostile to us. This was troublesome, for at the quarry we would hold discussions among ourselves, and a warder who did not permit us to talk was a great hindrance. I asked a certain comrade to befriend this fellow so that he would not interrupt our talks. The warder was quite crude, but he soon began to relax a bit around this one prisoner. One day, the warder asked this comrade for his jacket so that he could lay it on the grass and sit on it. Even though I knew it went against the comrade's grain, I nodded to him to do it. A few days later, we were having our lunch under the shed when this warder wandered over. The warder had an extra sandwich, and he threw it on the grass near us and said, "Here." That was his way of showing friendship. This presented us with a dilemma. On the one hand, he was treating us as animals to whom he could toss a bit of slop, and I felt it would undermine our dignity to take the sandwich. On the other hand, we were hungry, and to reject the gesture altogether would humiliate the warder we were trying to befriend. I could see that the comrade who had befriended the warder wanted the sandwich, and I nodded for him to take it. The strategy worked, for this warder became less wary around us. He even began to ask questions about the ANC. By definition, if a man worked for the prison service, he was probably brainwashed by the government's propaganda. He would have believed that we were terrorists and communists who wanted to drive the white man into the sea. But as we quietly explained to him our non-racialism, our desire for equal rights, and our plans for the redistribution of wealth, he scratched his head and said, "It makes more bloody sense than the Nats." Having sympathetic warders facilitated one of our most vital tasks on Robben Island, communication. We regarded it as our duty to stay in touch with our men in F and G, which was where the general prisoners were kept. As politicians, we were just as intent on fortifying our organization in prison as we had been outside. Communication was essential if we were to coordinate our protests and complaints. Because of the greater numbers of prisoners coming and going in the general section, the men in F and G tended to have more recent information about not only what was happening in the movement, but about our friends and families. Communication between sections was a serious violation of regulations. We found many effective ways around the ban. The men who delivered our drums of food were from the general section, and in the early months, we managed to have whispered conversations with them in which we conveyed brief messages. We formed a clandestine communications committee composed of Kathy, Mac Maharaj, Lalu Chiba, and several others, and their job was to organize all such practices. One of the first techniques was engineered by Kathy and Mac, who had noticed that on our walks to the quarry, the warders often tossed away empty matchboxes. They began secretly collecting them, and Mac had the idea of constructing a false bottom to the box and placing in it a tiny written message. Lalu Chiba, who once trained as a tailor, wrote out minuscule coded messages that would be placed in the converted matchbox. Joe Gabi, another MK soldier who was with us, would carry the matchboxes on our walks to the quarry and drop them at a strategic crossing where we knew the general prisoners would pass. Through whispered conversations at food deliveries, we explained the plan. Designated prisoners from F and G would pick up the matchboxes on their walks, and we retrieved messages in the same fashion. It was far from perfect, and we could easily be foiled by something as simple as the rain. We soon evolved more efficient methods. We looked for moments when the warders were inattentive. One such time was during and after meals. We helped ourselves to our food, and we worked out a scheme whereby comrades from the general section who worked in the kitchen began placing letters and notes wrapped in plastic at the bottom of the food drums. We sent return communication in a similar way, wrapping notes in the same plastic and placing them at the bottom of the mounds of dirty dishes that were routed back to the kitchen. We would do our best to create a mess, scattering food all over the plates. The warders even complained about the disarray, but never bothered to investigate. Our toilets and showers were adjacent to the isolation section. Prisoners from the general section were often sentenced to isolation there and would use the same set of toilets we did, though at different times. Mac devised a method of wrapping notes in plastic and then taping them inside the rim of the toilet bowl. We encouraged our political comrades in the general section to be charged and placed in isolation so that they could retrieve these notes and send replies. The warders never bothered to search there. In order not to have our notes read or understood by the authorities if they were found, we devised ways of writing that could not easily be seen or deciphered. One way was to write messages with milk. The milk would dry almost immediately and the paper would look blank. But the disinfectant we were given to clean ourselves, when sprayed on the dried milk, made the writing reappear. Unfortunately, we did not regularly receive milk. After one of us was diagnosed with an ulcer, we used his. Another technique was to write in tiny, coded script on toilet paper. The paper was so small and easily hidden that this became a popular way of smuggling out messages. When the authorities discovered a number of these communications, they took the extraordinary measure of rationing toilet paper. Govan was then ailing and not going to the quarry, and he was given the task of counting out 8 squares of toilet paper for each prisoner per day. But even with all these ingenious methods, one of the best ways was also the easiest, getting sent to the prison hospital. The island had one hospital, and it was difficult to segregate us from the general prisoners while we were there. Sometimes prisoners from the different sections even shared the same wards, and men from Section B and prisoners from F and G mingled and exchanged information about political organizations, strikes, go-slows, whatever the current prison issues were. Communication with the outside world was accomplished in 2 ways, through prisoners whose sentences were completed and who were leaving the island, and through contact with visitors. Prisoners who were leaving would smuggle out letters in their clothes or baggage. With outside visitors, the situation was even more dangerous because the risks were also borne by the visitor. When lawyers visited us, warders were not permitted in the room, and we would sometimes pass a letter to the lawyer to be taken out. Lawyers were not searched. In these meetings, we could also communicate by writing as we had during the Rivonia trial. Because the room was bugged, we might say, "Please tell," and then pause and write, "O.T., meaning Oliver Tambo, on a piece of paper, "that we approve of his plan to cut down the size of the..." and then write, "National Executive." Through a plastic-wrapped note hidden in our food drums, we learned in July of 1966 that the men in the general section had embarked on a hunger strike to protest poor conditions. The note was imprecise, and we did not know exactly when the strike had started or exactly what it was about. But we would support any strike of prisoners for whatever reason they were striking. Word was passed among us, and we resolved to initiate a sympathetic strike beginning with our next meal. A hunger strike consists of one thing, not eating. Because of the time lag in communications, the general prisoners probably did not learn of our participation for a day or so. But we knew that the news would hearten them. The authorities would be telling them that we were not participating in the strike, that we were gorging ourselves on gourmet meals. This was standard operating procedure. In a crisis, the authorities inevitably started a disinformation campaign to play one section against the other. In this case, while the ANC unanimously supported the strike, some PAC men in the general section did not. During the first day of our strike, we were served our normal rations and refused to take them. On the second day, we noticed that our portions were larger and a few more vegetables accompanied our pep. On the third day, juicy pieces of meat were served with supper. By the fourth day, the porridge was glistening with fat and great hunks of meat and colorful vegetables were steaming on top. The food was positively mouth-watering. The warders smiled when we passed up the food. The temptation was great, but we resisted, even though we were being driven especially hard at the quarry. We heard that in the main section, prisoners were collapsing and being taken away in wheelbarrows. I was called to the head office for an interview with Colonel Vessels. Such sessions were delicate, as my fellow prisoners knew that the authorities would attempt to influence me to call off the strike. Vessels was a direct man and demanded to know why we were on a hunger strike. I explained that as political prisoners, we saw protest to alter prison conditions as an extension of the anti-apartheid struggle. "But you don't even know why they are striking in F and G," he said. I said that did not matter, that the men in F and G were our brothers, and that our struggle was indivisible. He snorted and dismissed me. The following day, we learned of an extraordinary course of events. The warders had gone on their own food boycott, refusing to go to their own cafeteria. They were not striking in support of us, but had decided that if we could do such a thing, why couldn't they? They were demanding better food and improved living conditions. The combination of the two strikes was too much for the authorities. They settled with the warders, and then, a day or two later, we learned the authorities had gone to the general section and asked for three representatives to negotiate changes. The general prisoners declared victory and called off the hunger strike. We followed suit a day later. That was the first and most successful of the hunger strikes on the island. As a form of protest, they did not have a high success rate, and the rationale behind them always struck me as quixotic. In order for a hunger strike to succeed, the outside world must learn of it. Otherwise, prisoners will simply starve themselves to death and no one will know. Smuggled out information that we were on a hunger strike would elicit newspaper stories, which in turn would generate pressure from advocacy groups. The problem, particularly in the early years, was that it was next to impossible to alert people on the outside that we were waging a hunger strike inside. For me, hunger strikes were altogether too passive. We who were already suffering were threatening our health, even courting death. I have always favored a more active, militant style of protest, such as work strikes, go-slow strikes, or refusing to clean up. Actions that punished the authorities, not ourselves. They wanted gravel, and we produced no gravel. They wanted the prison yard clean, and it was untidy. This kind of behavior distressed and exasperated them, whereas I think they secretly enjoyed watching us go hungry. But when it came to a decision, I was often outvoted. My colleagues even jokingly accused me of not wanting to miss a meal. The proponents of hunger strikes argued that it was a traditionally accepted form of protest that had been waged all over the world by such prominent leaders as Mahatma Gandhi. Once the decision was taken, however, I would support it as wholeheartedly as any of its advocates. In fact, during the strikes, I was often in the position of remonstrating with some of my more wayward colleagues who did not want to abide by our agreement. "Madiba, I want my food," I remember one man saying. "I don't see why I should go without. I have served the struggle for many years." Comrades would sometimes eat on the sly. We knew this for a simple reason. By the second day of a hunger strike, no one needs to use the toilet. Yet one morning you might see a fellow going to the toilet. We had our own internal intelligence service because we knew that certain men were weak in this regard. Chapter 67. In the midst of the July 1966 hunger strike, I had my second visit from my wife. It was almost exactly 2 years after the first visit, and it nearly did not happen at all. Winnie had been under constant harassment since her first visit in 1964. Her sisters and brother were persecuted by the police, and the authorities attempted to forbid anyone in her family from living with her. Some of this I learned at the time. Much of it I found out later. Some of the nastiest items were known to me because when I would return from the quarry, I often would find neatly cut clippings about Winnie that had been anonymously placed on my bed by the warders. In small and spiteful ways, the authorities did their best to make Winnie's journeys as unpleasant as possible. For the previous 2 years, her visits had been stymied by local magistrates and by the repeated bannings that prevented her from traveling. I had recently heard through counsel that Winnie had been informed by the police that she could visit me only if she carried a pass. Winnie, who had been protesting the government's policy regarding women's passes since the 1950s, rightly refused to carry the hated document. The authorities were clearly attempting to humiliate her and me. But I thought it was more important that we see each other than to resist the petty machinations of the authorities, and Winnie consented to carry a pass. I missed her enormously and needed the reassurance of seeing her, and we also had vital family matters to discuss. The regulations governing each of Winnie's visits were long and complicated. She was barred from taking a train or car and had to fly, making the trip much more expensive. She was required to take the shortest route from the airport to Caledon Square, the Cape Town police station, where she was required to sign various documents. She had to report to the same station on the way back and sign more documents. I had also learned from a newspaper clipping that a special branch officer broke into our Orlando house while Winnie was dressing, and she reacted angrily, pushing the officer out of the bedroom. The lieutenant had laid a charge of assault against her, and I asked my friend and colleague George Bisos to defend her, which he ably did. We had seen stories about this in the newspapers, and some of the men even joked with me about Winnie's bellicosity. "You are not the only boxer in the family, Madiba," they said. This second visit was for only half an hour, and we had much to discuss. Winnie was a bit agitated from the rough treatment in Cape Town, and the fact that, as always, she had to ride in the hold of the ferry, where the fumes from the engine made her ill. She had taken pains to dress up for me, but she looked thin and drawn. We reviewed the education of the children, the health of my mother, which was not very good, and our finances. A critical issue was the education of Zenny and Zinzi. Winnie had placed the girls in a school designated as Indian, and the authorities were harassing the principal on the grounds that it was a violation of the law for the school to accept African pupils. We made the difficult decision to send Zenny and Zinzi to boarding school in Swaziland. This was hard on Winnie, who found her greatest sustenance in the two girls. I was consoled by the fact that their education would probably be superior there, but I worried about Winnie. She would be lonely and prey for people who sought to undermine her under the guise of being her friends. If anything, Winnie was too trusting of people's motives. To get around the restrictions on discussing non-family matters, we used names whose meaning was clear to us but not to the warders. If I wanted to know how Winnie was really doing, I might say, "Have you heard about Ngiyana recently? Is she all right?" Ngiyana is one of Winnie's clan names, but the authorities were unaware of that. Then Winnie could talk about how and what Ngiyana was doing. If the warder asked who Ngiyana was, we would say she was a cousin. If I wanted to know about how the external mission of the ANC was faring, I would ask, "How is the church?" Winnie would discuss the church in appropriate terms, and I might then ask, "How are the priests? Are there any new sermons?" We improvised and managed to exchange a great deal of information that way. As always, when the warder yelled, "Time up!" I thought only a few minutes had passed. I wanted to kiss the glass goodbye, but restrained myself. I always preferred for Winnie to leave first so she would not have to see me led away by the warders, and I watched as she whispered a goodbye, hiding her pain from the warders. After the visit, I replayed all the details in my mind, what Winnie wore, what she said, what I said. I then wrote her a letter going over some of what we had discussed and reminding her of how much I cared for her, how unshakable our bond was, how courageous she was. I saw my letters to her, both as love letters and as the only way I could give her the emotional support she needed. Soon after the visit, I learned that Winnie had been charged for failing to report to the police on her arrival in Cape Town, as well as refusing to furnish the police with her address when she left. Having already given her address at the ferry, she was asked again when she returned, and refused, saying she had done so earlier. Winnie was arrested and released on bail. She was tried and sentenced to a year's imprisonment, which was suspended except for 4 days. Winnie was subsequently dismissed from her second job as a social worker because of the incident and lost her main source of income. The state did its utmost to harass me in ways they thought I would be powerless to resist. Toward the end of 1966, the Transvaal Law Society, at the instigation of the Minister of Justice, made a motion to strike me off the roll of practicing attorneys as a result of my conviction in the Rivonia trial. Apparently, they were not discouraged by the earlier unsuccessful attempt to remove my name from the roll because of my conviction in the Defiance campaign. I found out about the Law Society's action only after it had been initiated. The Transvaal Law Society was an extremely conservative organization, and they were seeking to punish me at a time when they assumed I would be unable to defend myself. It is not easy for a prisoner on Robben Island to defend himself in court, but that is precisely what I intended to do. I informed the authorities that I planned to contest the action and would prepare my own defense. I told prison officials that in order to prepare adequately, I would need to be exempt from going to the quarry and would also require a proper table, chair, and reading light to work on my brief. I said I needed access to a law library and demanded to be taken to Pretoria. My strategy was to overwhelm the prison authorities and the courts with legitimate requests, which I knew they would have a difficult time satisfying. The authorities always found it distressing when I wanted to defend myself in court because the accompanying publicity would show that I was still fighting for the same values I always had. Their first response was, Mandela, why don't you retain a lawyer to defend you? He will be able to handle the case properly. Why put yourself out? I went ahead and applied to the registrar of the Supreme Court for the records, documents, and books that I would need. I also requested a list of the state's witnesses and summaries of their prospective testimony. I received a letter stating that before the court would grant my requests, they would need to know the nature of my defense. This was extraordinary. To ask the nature of a lawyer's defense before the trial? No defendant can be compelled to reveal his defense before he is actually in court. I wrote back to tell them that the nature of my defense would become clear to them when I filed my papers, and not until then. This was the beginning of a flurry of correspondence between me and the registrar, as well as the state attorney, who was representing the Law Society. I would not back down on any of my requests. The authorities were equally intransigent. I could not be taken off quarry detail. I could not have a table and chair, and under no circumstances would I be able to go to Pretoria to use the law library. I continued to bedevil the Law Society and registrar with demands, which they continued to deflect. Finally, several months and many letters later, without any fanfare and with just a cursory notification to me, they dropped the entire matter. The case was becoming more than they had bargained for. They had reckoned I would not have the initiative or wherewithal to defend myself. They were mistaken. I was able to read in detail about the official reactions to my opposition to the Law Society's actions because we were receiving a daily newspaper just as if it were delivered to our door. In effect, it was. The warder who supervised us at night was a quiet, elderly Jehovah's Witness whom Mac Maharaj had befriended. One night, he wandered over to Mac's cell and told him that he wanted to enter a newspaper contest that required an essay. Would Mac, he wondered, be willing to assist him in writing it? The old warder hinted that if Mac helped him, there would be a reward. Mac agreed and duly wrote the essay. A fortnight later, the old man came to Mac very excited. He was now a finalist in the competition. Would Mac write him another essay? The warder promised Mac a cooked chicken in return. Mac told the old warder that he would think about it. The next day, Mac came to Walter and me and explained the situation. While Walter encouraged Mac to accept the food, I appreciated his reluctance to do so because it would appear that he was getting special treatment. That night, he told the warder he would write the essay in exchange for a pack of cigarettes. The old warder agreed, and the following evening presented Mac with a newly bought pack of cigarettes. The next day, Mac told us that he now had the leverage he wanted over the old warder. How? We asked. Because I have his fingerprints on the cigarette pack, Mac said, and I can blackmail him. Walter exclaimed that that was immoral. I did not criticize Mac, but asked what he would blackmail him for. Mac raised his eyebrow. Newspapers, he said. Walter and I looked at each other. I think Walter was the only man on Robben Island who relished newspapers as much as I did. Mac had already discussed his plan with the Communications Committee, and although we both had reservations about Mac's technique, we did not stop him. That night, Mac told the warder that he had his fingerprints on the pack of cigarettes, and that if the old man did not cooperate, he would expose him to the commanding officer. Terrified of being fired and losing his pension, the warder agreed to do whatever Mac wanted. For the next 6 months, until the warder was transferred, the old man would smuggle that day's newspaper to Mac. Mac would then summarize the news and reduce it to a single, small piece of paper, which would circulate among us. The unfortunate warder did not win the contest either. It would be hard to say what we did more of at the quarry, mine lime or talk. By 1966, the warders had adopted a laissez-faire attitude. We could talk as much as we wanted as long as we worked. We would cluster in small groups, four or five men in a rough circle, and talk all day long about every subject under the sun. We were in a perpetual conversation with each other on topics both solemn and trifling. There is no prospect about prison which pleases, with the possible exception of one. One has time to think. In the vortex of the struggle, when one is constantly reacting to changing circumstances, one rarely has the chance to carefully consider all the ramifications of one's decisions or policies. Prison provided the time, much more than enough time, to reflect on what one had done and not done. We were constantly engaged in political debates. Some were dispatched in a day, others were disputed for years. I have always enjoyed the cut and thrust of debating and was a ready participant. One of our earliest and longest debates concerned the relationship between the ANC and the Communist Party. Some of the men, especially those MK soldiers who had been trained in socialist countries, believed that the ANC and the party were one and the same. Even some very senior ANC colleagues, such as Govan Mbeki and Harry Gwala, subscribed to this theory. The party did not exist as a separate entity on Robben Island. In prison, there was no point in making the distinction between the ANC and the party that existed on the outside. My own views on the subject had not altered in many years. The ANC was a mass liberation movement that welcomed all those with the same objectives. Over time, the debate concerning the ANC and the party grew progressively acrimonious. A number of us proposed one way to resolve it. We would write to the ANC in exile in Lusaka. We prepared a secret 22-page document on the subject with a covering letter from myself to be sent to Lusaka. It was a risky maneuver to prepare and smuggle out such a document. In the end, Lusaka confirmed the separation of the ANC and the party, and the argument eventually withered away. Another recurrent political discussion was whether or not the ANC leadership should come exclusively from the working class. Some argued that because the AMC was a mass organization made up mainly of ordinary workers, the leadership should come from those same ranks. My argument was that it was as undemocratic to specify that the leaders had to be from the working class as to declare that they should be bourgeois intellectuals. If the movement had insisted on such a rule, most of its leaders, men such as Chief Lituli, Moses Kotane, Dr. Dadu, would have been ineligible. Revolutionaries are drawn from every class. Not all debates were political. One issue that provoked much discussion was circumcision. Some among us maintained that circumcision, as practiced by the Xhosa and other tribes, was not only an unnecessary mutilation of the body, but a reversion to the type of tribalism that the ANC was seeking to overthrow. It was not an unreasonable argument, but the prevailing view, with which I agreed, was that circumcision was a cultural ritual that not only had a salutary health benefit, but an important psychological effect. It was a rite that strengthened group identification and inculcated positive values. The debate continued for years, and a number of men voted in favor of circumcision in a very direct way. A prisoner working in the hospital, who had formerly practiced as an Nthibi, set up a secret circumcision school, and a number of the younger prisoners from our section were circumcised there. Afterward, we would organize a small party of tea and biscuits for the men, and they would spend a day or two walking around in blankets, as was the custom. One subject we hearkened back to again and again was the question of whether there were tigers in Africa. Some argued that although it was popularly assumed that tigers lived in Africa, this was a myth, and they were native to Asia and the Indian subcontinent. Africa had leopards in abundance, but no tigers. The other side argued that tigers were native to Africa and some still lived there. Some claimed to have seen with their own eyes this most powerful and beautiful of cats in the jungles of Africa. I maintained that while there were no tigers to be found in contemporary Africa, there was a Xhosa word for tiger, a word different from the one for leopard, and that if the word existed in our language, the creature must have once existed in Africa. Otherwise, why would there be a name for it? This argument went round and round, and I remember Mac retorting that hundreds of years ago, there was a Hindi word for a craft that flew in the air, long before the airplane was invented. But that did not mean that airplanes existed in ancient India. Chapter 68. Zitulele, the quiet one, was what we called the tolerant, soft-spoken warder in charge of us at the quarry. He routinely stood a great distance from us while we worked, and did not appear to care what we did as long as we were orderly. He never berated us when he found us leaning on our spades and talking. We responded in kind. One day, in 1966, he came to us and said, "Gentlemen, the rains have washed away the lines on the roads. We need 20 kilos of lime today. Can you help?" Although we were working very little at the time, he had approached us as human beings, and we agreed to assist him. That spring, we had felt a certain thawing on the part of the authorities, a relaxation of the iron-fisted discipline that had prevailed on the island. The tension between prisoners and warders had lessened somewhat. But this lull proved to be short-lived, and came to an abrupt end one morning in September. We had just put down our picks and shovels on the quarry face and were walking to the shed for lunch. As one of the general prisoners wheeled a drum of food toward us, he whispered, "Fervort is dead." That was all. The news quickly passed among us. We looked at each other in disbelief and glanced over at the warders, who seemed unaware that anything momentous had occurred. We did not know how the Prime Minister had died. Later, we heard about the obscure, white, parliamentary messenger who stabbed Fervort to death, and we wondered at his motives. Although Fervort thought Africans were beneath animals, his death did not yield us any pleasure. Political assassination is not something I or the ANC has ever supported. It is a primitive way of contending with an opponent. Fervort had proved to be both the chief theorist and master builder of grand apartheid. He had championed the creation of the Bantustans and Bantu education. Shortly before his death, he had led the nationalists in the general election of 1966, in which the party of apartheid had increased its majority, winning 126 seats to the 39 achieved by the United Party and the single seat won by the Progressive Party. As often happened on the island, we had learned significant political news before our own guards. But by the following day, it was obvious the warders knew, for they took out their anger on us. The tension that had taken months to abate was suddenly at full force. The authorities began a crackdown against political prisoners as though we had held the knife that stabbed Fervort. The authorities always imagined that we were secretly linked with all kinds of powerful forces on the outside. The spate of successful guerrilla attacks against the South African police forces in Namibia by the Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO, an ally of the ANC, had also unnerved them. I suppose we should have been flattered that the government thought our nascent military ability was sophisticated enough to successfully eliminate their head of state. But their suspicions merely reflected the insecurities of narrow, short-sighted men who blamed their problems not on their own misguided policies, but on an opponent by the name of the ANC. The punishment against us was never enunciated as an official policy, but it was a renewal of the harsh atmosphere that prevailed upon our arrival on the island. The quiet one was replaced with a man who was a vicious martinet. His name was Von Rensburg, and he had been flown to the island on 24 hours' notice after the assassination. His reputation preceded him, for his name was a byword among prisoners for brutality. Von Rensburg was a big, clumsy, brutish fellow who did not speak but shouted. During his first day on the job, we noticed he had a small swastika tattooed on his wrist, but he did not need this offensive symbol to prove his cruelty. His job was to make our lives as wretched as possible, and he pursued that goal with great enthusiasm. Each day over the next few months, Von Rensburg would charge one of us for insubordination or malingering. Each morning, he and the other warders would discuss who would be charged that afternoon. It was a policy of selective intimidation, and the decision on who would be charged was taken regardless of how hard that prisoner had worked that day. When we were trudging back to our cells, von Rensburg would read from a list. Mandela, or Sisulu, or Kathrada, I want to see you immediately in front of the head of prison. The island's administrative court began working overtime. In response, we formed our own legal committee made up of myself, Fikeli Bam, and Mach Maharaj.